Wow, that's you're projecting, David, I think. No, it refers to whether one's an optimist or a pessimist. And I think, I mean, the high-temperature superconductors were discovered, what, 16 years ago now, and there must have been, what, tens of, perhaps even 100,000 papers written on these materials trying to understand the, you know, unusual and strange behavior of these materials. And I do think it's, one can broadly divide those of us in the trenches thinking about these materials into two classes, and let me call them optimists and pessimists. And I think the optimists like to believe that hidden underneath the strange behavior somewhere is some simplicity, some universality. If only we could nail down what it is, everything would, you know, come together and make a lot of sense. I think others in the field, perhaps I'm unfairly calling them as pessimists, think that what the cuprates are very complicated interwoven system, and in order to understand it, they might believe one has to, you know, disentangle it thread by thread, basically. Really, the devil's in the details would be that approach. Anyway, I would like to tell you about some things we've been thinking about the last, really, 4 or 5 years, trying to search for some underlying universality in the cuprate phase diagram. And in particular, what one tends to want to focus on is what I want to call the abnormal states, which is the behavior of the material, the high-temperature superconductors, outside of the superconducting phase, either because one's at a doping concentration where there's no superconductivity, or when one's in the normal state above TC. And really, I think the key to understanding the high-temperature superconducting behavior, I think, really lies in trying to understand the normal state behavior, which, as I will try to remind you, is really quite unusual. What I want to then tell you about is efforts I've been involved in really the last 10 years or so, which is to try to reformulate 2D interacting electron theories in a vortex spin-on field theory. So this is really basically a dual representation of two-dimensional interacting electrons, where we, rather than focusing on the positions of the electrons per se, we're going to focus on the wave-like nature of the underlying quantum fields, and in particular, focus on vortex degrees of freedom, which are interacting with some spin-ons, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. And what I will then talk about is some of the exotic ground states, quantum ground states, which emerge very naturally when one looks at interacting electrons in a dual representation. In particular, I'll tell you a little bit about spin charge separated insulators, and I'll tell you why I don't think the spin charge separated insulator is what's underlying the cuprate behavior. And then at the end, I'll tell you about some very recent work, and this is actually unpublished. We haven't even put the preprint on the server yet. Is a description of a rather bizarre two-dimensional non-Fermi liquid conducting state, which we're calling the roton spin-on liquid. And this work here on the spin charge separation was predominantly with Sentel, and this more recent work is in collaboration with Leon, who couldn't bring himself to come and listen to me talk about this material. Okay, so let me remind you about the abnormal states in the cuprates. I'm going to draw perpendicular lines here. The phase diagram that most of you have seen more times than you can remember, I'm sure, plotted in the temperature doping axis. And for example, let me just sketch it in and then remind you of what the various features are. Okay, so when one's in the stoichiometric materials at x equals 0, then that corresponds, it turns out, to the electrons in the d shell of the copper atoms being in the uppermost of those orbitals. The so-called dx squared minus y squared orbital is half filled. And so these parent compounds one can think of then focusing on the two-dimensional aspect of the cuprates, where I think most of the important physics is going on, as a square lattice of copper. Square lattice of copper atoms, excuse me, as I'm sure you all know. separated by oxygen atoms, and there are 9 electrons in the d shell of the copper atoms, and due to the crystal field splitting, the different d shell states are split, and in the uppermost of those levels, the dx squared minus y squared orbital, there's 1 electron. And band theory would predict metallic behavior when you have a half-filled upper band, but what's found is that at x equals 0, the material's an anti-ferromagnetically ordered Mott insulator. Okay, and basically what's happening is, due to the strong Coulomb repulsion between the electrons are getting stuck, frozen, onto their individual copper atoms, if you will, and are immobilized by the Coulomb repulsion between neighboring electrons, which frustrates and makes it energetically unfavorable for them to move around. And so they freeze into an insulating state where the electrons, are immobilized, and they, at moderately high temperatures, in fact, order into an anti-ferromagnetically ordered pattern like this. Now, things get much more interesting, of course, as you know, when we start doping. We substitute some strontium for some lanthanum, and that basically removes electrons out of the copper-oxygen planes, leaving holes, and these holes are then free to move around, or if you will, the electrons are free to hop into the position where the hole was, and so forth. And so there one gets some conducting behavior setting in once one puts the doping to be about 5% or so, and the antiferromagnetism rapidly disappears, and then one enters into the superconducting state, the so-called superconducting dome. Here it's some doping, optimal doping. This is in the range of 15% doping or so. And then eventually, as one dopes significantly much out to about 25% or 30% holes, one seems to recover what looks like rather conventional metallic behavior in the sort of very overdoped regime, even though there's actually not as much data here as one would like. Okay, but what I want to really focus on are the normal states, the abnormal states. That is the so-called pseudo-gap regime and this strange metal phase here. So what the experiments tell us is, in fact, that there seems to be some sort of crossover temperature scale. It's a crossover. It doesn't seem to be a real phase transition, below which, as one enters this pseudo-gap regime, the electrons seem to be pairing naively into Cooper pairs. There seems to be into singlets. There seems to be a spin gap opening up. But even though one superficially looks like one has a superconducting pairing going on, the material is not superconducting until one goes to significantly lower temperatures. Okay, so that's pretty puzzling. That's really rather unusual behavior that we don't really understand very well, I think it's fair to say. But perhaps even more interesting in some regards, and really the original mystery of the normal state, was so-called optimal doping in this what's now called the strange metal phase, where there is what's called non-Fermi liquid transport behavior, which doesn't seem to fit into the standard paradigms of Fermi liquid theory. And I'll remind you what those are in a moment. So now, what is the goal here for a theorist? I mean, I of course like to be able to, in some realistic way, calculate what the phase diagram is going to be in detail and what the transition temperature is and so forth. But the goal for an unrealistic theorist like myself is really just to try to understand whether or not there are universal properties of these normal states, and try to understand those universal properties, and if one can understand those, understand how and why superconductivity emerges as one cools down. Okay, and in order to give you a flavor for how one would approach that, let me just sketch what would happen if one tried to implement just the absolutely standard Fermi liquid approaches to the normal state of the high-temperature superconductors. And this is really approaches that have been tried by many people in the field and are still being advocated by, I think, a lot of people in the field, even though I think a number of us, and probably many of us, feel that it's really going to involve something much more unusual, ultimately, to explain the strange metal phase, for example. So the Fermi liquid paradigm, in very brief, from a modern viewpoint, one basically would start, as we always do in condensed matter theory, with our theory of everything, the Hamiltonian, consisting of the kinetic energy of the electrons, the kinetic energy of the nuclei, plus the Coulomb interactions. Of course, this is completely intractable. So what do? We try to focus on lower energy degrees of freedom. We almost always ignore the inner core energy, the core electrons near the nuclei, and focus on the outer orbitals. And in the context of the cuprates, one really typically reduces the problem down to a one-band Hubbard model, where one's focusing on basically as I say, just electrons moving in this dx squared minus y squared band. And the standard Hubbard model in its simplest form is just an on-site Coulomb repulsion between the electrons. And so this is what was viewed as an effective Hamiltonian. And on an energy scale, which is maybe valid between 1 and 5 electron volts, and lower energies, one would hope. Unfortunately, the Hubbard model is proving to be just about as intractable as the original microscopic model, although there has been some progress made, in particularly in the undoped situation. But in this sort of region of optimal doping, where one really would like to understand what's going on, there's serious technical problems with the Hubbard model. So what is one to do? Well, what one can continue to do is basically continue to consider lower and lower energy effective theories. So one can take the Hubbard model and imagine, at least formally, integrating out degrees of freedom, high energy degrees of freedom, the electronic states on the scale of 1 to 5 electron volts, and deriving effective theories in which one systematically lowers the cutoff down. And this is, you know, at least in the spirit of the normalization group. And what one would like to follow then is what happens to the normalization group flow equations in these effective Hamiltonians as we go to lower and lower energies. Now, to actually implement this in practice is next to impossible, but the power of the normalization group is not really as a computational tool, but as a way to organize thinking about complex physical systems on different energy and length scales. And so in particular, what one might expect to happen is that there will be simplicity coming out of the normalization group flows, where one gets attracted to certain fixed points in the space of Hamiltonians. And the fixed point, you know, the star fixed point underlying, you know, essentially all of solid state physics is the Fermi liquid fixed point, which attracts the flows in this multidimensional space of Hamiltonians in almost all directions. There is one direction in the space of Hamiltonians which is unstable, where the Fermi liquid is, in fact, marginally unstable. And that's when one puts on attractive interactions, perhaps mediated by phonons, into the Cooper channel. And then one has an instability which drives one over to the superconducting fixed point at lower temperatures. And the power of BCS theory is not only in describing the nature of the superconducting phase, but in describing this, in fact, universal crossover from the Fermi liquid fixed point, which describes the behavior basically above TC in the normal state, over to the superconducting fixed point. And so what one imagines in the standard approach to, for example, an elemental superconductor like niobium, is that one has an effective Hamiltonian for niobium sitting out here at strong coupling when one's looking on scales of 100 electron volts. But by the time one scales down to maybe an electron volt or so, one is living in the vicinity of the Fermi liquid fixed point. And then one lives there for quite a while, and then finally when one gets down to maybe 10 degrees Kelvin or so, a millielectron volt, one crosses over and goes into the superconducting state. And so to understand basically materials whose microscopic Hamiltonians happen to be in the basin of attraction of the Fermi liquid fixed point, it suffices, at least if one wants to understand things on scales which are a few orders of magnitude below the, you know, basic electronic energy scales, to understand the Fermi liquid fixed point and the crossover to the BCS superconducting fixed point. Okay, and the beauty of the Fermi liquid fixed point is its amazing simplicity. I mean, it's essentially the Fermi liquid is adiabatically connected to non-attracting electrons.
Matt, before you,
yeah?
The diagram,
was it? Oh, no, I will not erase that.
Was
yeah.
it intentional that you did not draw a line separating the strange metal and Fermi
liquid? No, I mean, there is, in fact, very recent data about in photo emission from Campuzano, I was talking to just last week. You know, there's some indirect evidence for some sort of crossover on this side as well coming. Rising what looks to be rather steeply. Well, I believe so. Yeah, I don't think there's really evidence for phase transition. Here it's a little sharper, and but basically still pretty smooth. So the Fermi liquid fixed point is, as I say, adiabatically connected to the free Fermi gas. And the free Fermi gas, we just minimize the kinetic energy of the electrons. In the continuum or in Jellium, we just fill up a Fermi C out to some Fermi wave vectors KF. And of course, the excitations out above the ground state are promoting electrons from inside the Fermi C and putting them just outside the Fermi C at slightly higher energies. Yeah?
So, is there evidence that the coal lines actually meet or are inside, well inside the supercritical?
Yeah, I don't really want to discuss the details of these crossover lines right now. I mean, I mean, there's a lot known about these crossover lines and all sorts of experiments, and let me just, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, although, I mean, it does, although many of the predictions, for example, even sort of non-universal things like the ratio of the gap, 2 delta to KTC, doesn't matter whether the attractive interactions is phonons or something else. So most of the physical predictions actually are independent of the fact that the glue that binds the Cooper pairs together is the phonons, although there are some, as you well know. But I mean, Ginzburg-Landau theory, by contrast, would describe the universal properties of the superconducting phase, but would not describe, the single electron excitations in the metallic state. I mean, that's an important distinction. Yeah, no, the code non-engineering abilities, yeah. So I don't want to, I mean, the actual source, that really, in some sense, what we're saying is, even with Coulomb interactions, you can end up on this side of the phase diagram when you scale down in energies, at least for, if this direction is a sort of high angular momentum pairing. Okay, but the virtue of the Fermi liquid, of course, is that one has the Landau quasi-particle excitations, which are in one-to-one correspondence with the particle excitations of the free Fermi gas, are basically behave like weakly interacting particles. So in particular, if you consider an electron promoted above the Fermi energy by an energy omega, the scattering rate of that quasi-particle is much smaller than the energy of the state itself, of the excited state itself, if at least on scale small compared to the Fermi energy. And the Fermi energy is typically 10 electron volts or some large energy scale. So if one's focusing on relatively low energies near the Fermi surface, one can get away with basically a description in terms of Landau quasi-particles, which, for all intents and purposes, behave like electrons. They're fermions, they have spin a half charge E. You can label them by momentum, they have some effective mass, and so forth. And in particular, because of that, one would expect that the electron spectral function in a Fermi liquid, the electron spectral function being essentially the probability that you find an electron in the material with momentum k and energy omega, if one's at zero temperature in a clean material, and if one looks right on the Fermi surface, then these quasi-particles are infinitely long-lived, plus incoherent background, basically plus regular terms. But so it's a well-defined resonance, the particle, which is infinitely long-lived when it sits right on the Fermi surface. And what's really nicest about this is that when one looks at the electrical transport, one can basically get away looking at the transport of individual electrons. And the fact that they're strongly interacting isn't really so important. And one can basically write down F equals ma for the individual electrons. One puts in some momentum relaxation time and then says that the electrons accelerated in a magnetic field and curve in a magnetic field and accelerate in an electric field. And one can just do single particle dynamics to calculate things like the electrical resistance. Let me make sure I get this right in the head. Which is proportional to the momentum relaxation rate. And something like the Hall effect, you can look at the cotangent of the Hall angle, which is the Hall resistance divided by, the longitudinal resistance divided by the Hall resistance. This is at low field within Fermi liquid theory, given also by the momentum relaxation rate, where here omega c is a cyclotron frequency. Okay, so this comes out of simple Fermi liquid theory, basically just looking at individual electrons, and leads to standard metallic transport behavior, And essentially what one really has to understand in a Fermi liquid is the various scattering processes that the electrons suffer. And the electrons can scatter off impurities, they can scatter off other electrons, they can scatter off phonons, and this leads to the resistance, the proportion of the scattering rate, taking a form which looks something like this. But this is room temperature. Typically, one will actually be dominated by electrons scattering off the phonons and relaxing their momentum that way. And as one comes down in temperature, the phonons rapidly freeze out, and one gets an impurity contribution, which is temperature dependent at very low temperatures. And so this is sort of standard Fermi liquid and metallic transport, which describes, you know, very well simple metals. And of course, those simple metals which become superconducting, then at very low temperatures, maybe 10 Kelvin or so, the resistance drops rapidly, you know, essentially to zero. Okay, so how does that compare with what's seen experimentally in the high temperature superconductors in the normal state? Well, what one finds is that in the strange metal phase, and this was emphasized by, you know, soon after the discovery of the materials, is that the resistance looks to a rather good approximation out to temperatures even as high as 500 Kelvin to be linear. I can't draw a straight line here. And then the material becomes superconducting at whatever it is, you know, 90 Kelvin. And so one gets a resistance which is linear in temperature. And so this is a puzzle that's different than what one would expect. You know, it's not clear, you know, if one has lambda quasi-particles, why are the phonons leading to a more interesting and complicated temperature dependence of this electrical resistance? What's perhaps as puzzling is the fact that the cotangent of the Hall angle varies as a power that's different than linear. It varies as a power of t squared. And in Fermi liquid theory, one expects really these two to track one another, at least at low temperatures. But the thing I want to really emphasize that is the rather remarkable fact that in the cleanest single crystal materials, near optimal and slightly overdoped, if you extrapolate this linear resistance, it gets very close to extrapolating to a zero value at zero temperature. So it's almost as if this strange metal, if we could get rid of the superconductivity somehow and follow the resistance down, that it's almost as if it's behaving like a superconductor, which is superconducting only at zero temperature. Okay. And I've already mentioned that the pseudo-gap phase has aspects of it which are rather like a superconductor in the sense that it looks like the electrons are pairing together. And so that's something I'm going to come back to in a moment when we talk about the vortex spin-on field theory, is the fact that both of these abnormal states, the strange metal and the pseudo-gap, have seem to be close cousins, if you will, to the superconducting state itself. And let me just mention the electron spectral function, though, in the cuprate, because I mentioned the transport. One does measure, as you know, a Fermi surface in the cuprates, separating the regions in momentum space where the states are occupied from those where the states are unoccupied. It seems to be a Fermi surface, and Lunge's theorem seems to be obeyed with this Fermi surface. But what's rather interesting is the amount of scattering that goes on when the its energy is just above the Fermi energy near this Fermi surface. In particular, in the strange metal, there seems to be what are called hot spots, where there's excessive scattering near these parts of the Fermi surface. And that's in the normal state when one's right above TC. As one cools below the transition temperature, these hot spots become cold, and they seem to turn off. And that's something, you know, one would like to really try to understand. In the pseudo-gap regime, as one cools below T star, one gets something even more unusual happening. Even though one's not in the superconducting state, one seems to be finding that the energy of the electron states near what was the Fermi surface are getting lifted up. And in fact, one gets what looks like a gap, which has the same form and magnitude as the superconducting gap that one gets inside the superconducting state itself. But as I emphasize again, the pseudo-gap is certainly not superconducting. It's, you know, perfectly resistive. Okay, so I think for these reasons, many people feel that the cuprates just do not fit very easily into the standard Fermi liquid paradigm. And I think at least I would like to advocate searching for other fixed points. Okay, so this is really the main.
Yeah, before you erase that.
No, I'm not going to erase this. Oh, erase can. This. Yeah.
I'm aware of the fact that people have studied what happens around the Fermi, yeah, right, Rajaraman and so on.
Yeah.
Have people done the same thing for the superconducting fixed point?
Yeah, the superconducting fixed point is really stable in almost everything.
So
yeah.
Look,
no, it's stable and just about. I mean, temperature. I'm really thinking about zero temperature flows. Yeah, it's stable to everything, basically. Yeah. I mean, you know, you can turn on strong perturbations, but basically, particularly in an S-wave superconductor, you have a gap. You know, when you have a gap opening up, the things are less sensitive, you know, to perturbations and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, in some sense, one might have guessed that. But see, the Fermi liquid has all these low energy excitations. It's very fragile, and it's, you know, it's easy, you know, to destabilize it relative to the superconducting phase, in which, you know, already has sort of gapped out most of the excitations. Okay, so basically what some of us have been looking for is another fixed point which will play the role of the Fermi liquid fixed point did for, you know, Fermi liquid theory and for BCS theory. So to look for some other fixed point, some new fixed point up here, which is better be stable in most directions, otherwise you're never going to find it in any real material. And one would then like to suggest that the cuprate Hamiltonian is actually living near this fixed point than the Fermi liquid fixed point. And that as one scales down from 10 electron volts, maybe to 1 electron volt, one maybe comes down and lives in the vicinity of this new fixed point. If we understand this new fixed point, then one might be able to understand what its instabilities are. And if one's lucky, one will have instability towards the superconducting state coming in from some other direction. Okay, so that's sort of the goal. I think the pessimistic view is that the cuprates are sitting over here somewhere that is far away from any fixed point. You know, have just a strong coupling in space of Hamiltonians, and one has to just follow the detailed flow, non-universal flow, because it really depends on exactly where you start.
Why don't you put it near an anti-ferromagnetic?
It could be near anti-ferromagnetic fixed points, but I think you really have to address the charge sector of the theory on the scale of, you know, half an electron volt here. And I don't think it's sitting that near the anti-fermi fixed point right here, although maybe, you know, it's open to argument, obviously, right? So I really believe what we need, if that's, well, I think what we really need is a conducting, you know, non-Fermi liquid conducting fixed point.
Why not put it near a strike?
You can try all sorts of things, yeah. No, and that's what that's where the challenge is to find, well, is to identify new fixed points. I mean, that's one approach, and study their behaviors, their universal properties, their instabilities, and try to correlate it with the experiments, and, you know, and try to get some microscopic handles as well. Yeah, so I'm certainly not the only person taking this route. I think, you know, many, if not most, in the field are following this.
Yeah, real pessimists would say that there may be a different theory for different material.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Can that be ruled out or no?
No, I mean, I think, you know, low temperature superconductors, you know, if you take now, I mean, you take lead, well, lead strong coupling, but other superconductors, you find, you know, they all basically end up, you know, being well described by Fermi liquid and then crossing over and becoming superconducting at low temperatures. So, you know, simplicity emerges at low, when you have the separation of energy scales, if you're lucky. The thing is, the cuprates, a lot of the interesting physics, you know, is already occurring on pretty high energy scales, you know, an electron volt scale, or maybe half an electron volt. So, you know, there is the worry that there's not even enough, you know, a large enough range of energy scales to renormalize from the cuprates down to any putative new fixed point. So that's also a concern. You know, and that's going to complicate things for sure. But you do what you can do. Okay, so let me just then describe the, my particular, you know, search for new fixed points. And the motivation for these dual formulation really comes from the fact that both the pseudo-gap and the strange metal have aspects of them which are sort of suggestive of superconductivity. The pseudo-gap has a D-wave gap opening up, seemingly D-wave gap, you know, as if it were going into a superconducting state even though it's not superconducting. And the strange metal, if one extrapolates its resistance down to very low temperature, seems to be, you know, rather a good conductor and, you know, almost perhaps superconducting. So with that motivation, one might like to develop a dual description of electrons in which one focuses on, well, in which one uses the quantum fields which create the excitations in a conventional 2D BCS superconductor. Okay, so this is what I want to do is to try to build a field theory using, rather than as a microscopic field, the electron, using sort of coarse, slightly coarse-grained or low-energy effective fields, and those fields are going to be the fields which create and destroy the basic excitations inside a two-dimensional BCS superconductor. And what are those excitations? Well, there are three. There's the Bolger-Yubov quasiparticles. There are HC over 2E vortices, which are point-like objects. And there is the collective plasmon. Okay, so let me just very briefly, remind you of these three excitations and how we're going to build this theory. Basically, we can think of course, the superconductor as being built from a Cooper pair condensate. We can introduce some complex bosonic field, which has an amplitude and a phase. And one argues that at least inside the superconducting state, this is non-zero, the breaking of the symmetry. The Bolger-Yubov quasiparticles are essentially an unpaired electron, breaking a pair. The HC over 2E vortices, which are point-like singularities in two dimensions, are places where the amplitude of the pair field goes to zero, and the phase of the pair field changes by 2 pi when one encircles a vortex. So one can think of this as taking a Cooper pair, singlet up and down spin electrons, and dragging it around a vortex. And the complex wave function describes that boson, that Cooper pair, winds by 2 pi. And of course, it's this single valueness of the Cooper pair wave function which is what quantizes the vortices in the first place. That's why quantum vortices come in, integer amounts of angular momentum, in fact. And so you have positive and negative circulation vortices where the phase winds by minus 2 pi or plus 2 pi. And finally, the plasmon is essentially the Goldstone mode. And with Coulomb interactions, there's sort of a quasi-Higgs effect going on and so forth. It's not really important for what to talk about. We can put in the Coulomb interactions if we want. The one subtlety, though, in building a field theory then, what? A field theory that's going to work with the Bolger-Yubov of quasiparticles. It's going to be a field theory in which we introduce an operator, which is going to be a vortex number operator, which is an integer, plus 1 or minus 1, depending on the circulation of the vortices. We're going to introduce a vortex creation operator, which is going to commute with the vortex number operator in the usual way. And we, in fact, are going to have a vector potential and a conjugate electric field. And I'll specify this in slightly more detail in a moment. Which are going to encode or embody the longitudinal sound mode that's inside the superconducting state. But a very subtle and complication of using these variables is the fact that it turns out there's a long-range interaction between the Bolger-Yubov quasiparticles and the HC over 2E vortices. And
question. Yeah? Vortices and anti-vortices?
Yeah. Yes. Both. Yeah. So in particular, and you can see that, I already said a vortex, is if you take a...
I have a question.
Yeah?
If you're looking at a low-energy effective theory, but the plasmon and the Bolger-Yubov particle, they both have a big gap, right?
Yeah.
Can't you argue that they shouldn't be in theory?
Okay, so there's two answers to that. One is you really need this field here because it's going to describe the longitudinal charge fluctuations in the system, whereas the vortices are going to describe the transverse charge fluctuation. So, a complete theory has to have both in any case.
But if they're sufficiently high energy.
Well, then they may not be important, but the theory will tell us that, when we solve it. But actually, the other thing is even though I'm using the superconducting state as a motivation for developing the theory in terms of these fields, I want to be able to use the theory in terms of these fields to describe non-superconducting behavior. So the way one wants to think about it is this operator, e to the I theta, creates a bare vortex. It's going to be described by some Hamiltonian. Inside the superconducting state, that's going to get renormalized and dressed and become the vortex. Right, in the same way that, you know, a bare electron operator is not the lambda quasiparticle, but when it gets dressed, it is. Right, so, but one has this complication, the fact that both UF quasiparticles and vortices get confused when they're both present in the superconducting state. And the reason is that when you take a Cooper pair around a vortex, you pick up a 2 pi. If you imagine taking an electron around the vortex, dragging it around, you could ask, what phase are you going to accumulate? Now, you might have guessed that you'd accumulate a phase of pi. Now, that kind of seems reasonable. If you take 2 electrons, you get 2 pi. But that's, you know, that can't be that, because the electron, if this is an electron, the electron wave function is single-valued, right? So when the electron wave function has to come back to itself. But if you imagine, so what you really want to do is not drag an electron. You want to imagine doing a Berry's phase type of argument where you put on some Zeeman field, which breaks a Cooper pair by, you know, having an up magnetic field here and a down magnetic field here, and taking the down electron, dragging it far away, and taking this up spin excitation and moving it adiabatically around the vortex, then one does actually acquire a phase of pi. Okay? So that excitation you're created that way physically with putting on a Zeeman field is not an electron. And I'm going to call it a spin-on. It's just a name. And the spin-on operator is basically defined as you create an electron and you remove half of a Cooper pair. So it's basically, remember I had this, you know, CC. So it's defining essentially an electrically neutral spin 1/2 fermionic operator, which doesn't, you know, isn't transformed under the, you know, electromagnetic U1 transformation. But and I think you really are more or less forced to work with these spin-on excitations. I should say that inside the superconducting state itself, the phase of the pair wave function is usually taken just as a constant, 0, and then the spin-on is the same as an electron. But once we start considering describing phases outside of superconducting phase, that's no longer the case. Okay, so let me just write down the Hamiltonian. Then I'll just tell you about the various phases, these two phases which come out. Okay, so we're going to write the Hamiltonian. I think maybe I'll just use it right here. Okay, so the Hamiltonian is going to consist of 3 parts, a part describing the spin-ons, a piece describing the plasmon, and a piece describing the vortices. And the piece describing the spin-ons is going to look like just the Bolger-Yubov-Jenn equation, except in terms of the spin-on operators. Oops. This I'm looking at room. I do want to kind of write out the whole Hamiltonian. Actually, it's a little bit long, but I mean, I want to give you a feel that I'm actually doing, you know, some real calculations, and I haven't even got to the model yet. You know, so that is a part of the challenge here, is to familiarize oneself and others with the degrees of freedom one's actually using. So in particular, let me, you know, draw the square lattice that this theory is going to be defined on. And the F particles live on the sites of the lattice. You can basically think of them as electrons, except they're electrically neutralized. And this, as I say, is essentially the Bolger-Yubov-Jenn Hamiltonian that one has inside the superconducting state, describing the quasiparticles. There's going to be one complication here. There's going to be a gauge field beta, which is going to be introduced. And I'm going to actually have to introduce 2 gauge fields, beta and alpha, which are going to give one this statistical interaction between the vortices and the spin-ons. Okay, so these particles are minimally coupled to some gauge field beta. The plasmon Hamiltonian is really very simple. It's just some quadratic theory in terms of these electric fields. Let me just write it very schematically. and setting all constants equal to 1. So here one has, in fact, which I didn't say, that the curl of this vector potential incidentally lives on the links of the dual lattice, and its curl, the curl of the vector potential around a single site, is equal to the charge density, the electrical charge density. Okay, so this is a harmonic theory, ENA canonically conjugate. You can diagonalize this, and if you do, you get the Goldstone mode inside the superconducting phase. If you have short-range interactions, it linearly disperses and so forth. But you can, you know, make this longer-range interactions if you want. And then finally, the vortex Hamiltonian consists of the usual piece, which gives on the interaction between the vortices, which in two dimensions is just a logarithmic interaction. And then there's a piece which is the kinetic energy of the vortices, which puts all the quantum mechanics into the vortex degrees of freedom. Okay, so, oh, yeah, and let me just write down, for example, what the kinetic energy of the vortices looks like. The vortices, I should say, live on the plaquettes of this lattice. And the one will have things like hopping terms . Okay, so this is basically the four Hamiltonian. Okay, so what this term does is it describes the hopping of a vortex from one plaquette to the next. And the vortices are minimally coupled to the gauge field A, and they're also minimally coupled to the gauge field alpha. And alpha and beta don't commute with one another the beta fields live on the links of the real lattice, the alpha fields live on the links of the dual lattice. On those links which don't cross one another, they don't commute with one another. And those encode the statistical interaction to make sure that when you take a vortex around a spin on a spin around a vortex, you get the minus sign. Do you need
a couple confusions? Theta, yeah. And phi the same thing?
I don't see a phi.
No, you wrote down e to the I phi before.
No, that's certainly not. Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah, so e to the I theta creates a vortex.
Right.
So there's no Cooper pairs, the particles, the electrons, and the Cooper pairs are. They're all not really directly obvious where they are. They sort of disappear when, like, dual variables. Okay, so alpha and beta. Alpha is a gauge field which lives on the, which is essentially conjugate to beta. And alpha lives on the links of the dual lattice, and beta lives on the links of the real lattice. And capital N. Oh, little n is, yeah. So little n is 1 minus x, let's say, right? Is the back? Is it sets the average density? Yeah, we fixed that.
Alpha has only
single letters. Yeah, so alpha is just a, yeah, exactly, just this real quantity living on the links.
So how should we introduce alpha?
Well, no, okay, well, I need to introduce alpha and beta in order to encode the statistical interaction between the spin-ons and the vortices to give me the minus sign when I take one around the other.
Now, n is them taken to be fixed, it's not fluctuating.
Well, no, n fluctuates because, okay, n doesn't commute with theta.
Little n is not f.
No, little n.
Little n.
Big n is not.
Yeah, little n is not an operator. This
is not f theta f.
I'm sorry, this is the average density. It's not an operator. Big, yeah, this is, it's like a chemical potential which just fixes the overall density. And, okay, so, I mean, you know, this looks complicated, but actually isn't. If you just drop if you want to describe a BCS superconductor, you just drop the kinetic energy of the vortices. You say the vortices are expelled from the system. That's, you know, the defining characteristic of a superconductor. And you have then the alpha field drops out of the Hamiltonian, and the beta field, which doesn't commute with alpha, it doesn't matter. You can just set beta equal to 0. And then you have Bolyai Zeng equation deciding the quasiparticles. You have the collective mode describing the Goldstone mode. And you have, okay, vortices which you can create, you know, paying a logarithmic interaction between them, but it costs a finite amount of energy. And what one can now do is start playing games. We want to start getting out of the superconducting phase by cranking up the kinetic energy of the vortices. And in fact, what we're going to do is consider three types of vortex hopping processes. And each one will correspond to a different quantum ground state that we go into when we crank up its amplitude. So we're going to consider increasing the amplitude of the single vortex hopping. So that would be like taking T1 to infinity, if you will, is T1. OK, I'm going to add in, which I haven't done here, terms which correspond to hopping of a pair of vortices. it would take the exact same form of that cosine there, but with, you know, factors of 2, 2, 2, and 2. I don't, but if I, it turns out when I crank up the amplitude for that, the paravortex hopping term, is it's going to drive me into a spin-charge separated insulating state. And it's not very obvious, but, and then the third process I want to consider is what I'm going to call a roton hopping. Okay, so that, let me just, so here's the square lattice. The single vortex hopping is just what I said. The paravortex is where you have a double strength vortex, which hops. And then the roton hopping term is when one takes a positive and negative circulating vortex and one hops them both at right angles. And you know, this is, if you have a vortex ring, in three dimensions of vortex rings, if you take a slice of a ring, you get a positive and negative vortex. And you know, smoke rings, you know, move at right angles to, and so this is actually a very natural dynamics to give to the rotons. And so I'm going to have an amplitude k rot for the hopping process here. Okay, what one can now do is just, as I say, in turn, start in the superconductor and then crank up the single vortex hopping and make it very large and solve the theory as best one can. Crank up the paravortex hopping, solve the theory as best one can. Crank up the roton hopping, solve the theory as best one can. Well, no, so it's I haven't written explicitly either the paravortex hopping term or the roton hopping term, but they're going to just be, they're going to look like this cosine term, but factors of 2 here, or there's going to be, in this roton hopping case, there's going to be 4 thetas, theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, theta 4 as I hop around.
Those terms contain any one of those A.
Yeah, no, they're all you know, minimally coupled in the same way to A and alpha. Yeah.
But how do you know that those coefficients are not functions of the ones you already have, like T1?
No, I know. Right now, I'm just searching for exotic phases. You know, when, yeah.
Just quantum numbers.
Well, no. So these are just, this is just amplitudes of terms in Hamiltonian, right? And I just want to consider taking one term in Hamiltonian large. I mean, that's, we always do that. If you have a Hamiltonian which is complicated, you say, I want to take one term large, solve it, and then, you know, do perturbation theory in the other. So, you know, here, if I take this term to be 0, this is a trivial model. I've solved it. It's a tribe of superconductor. I want to now crank up T1 and take it off to infinity, solve it. Then take T2 off to infinity, solve it. And what you get is you get 3 different phases. Okay, you find a Fermi liquid. I mean, basically, you find a Fermi liquid. This is the, you know, that gives you the hardest possible description of a Fermi liquid coming from this dual set of variables. When you crank up the paravortex hopping, this gives you a spin charge separated insulator. And when you crank up the roton hopping term, one gets this new phase, the roton spin on liquid phase, which is the thing that are most interesting in at the moment. And so let me just very briefly give you just a flavor for how this works. You know, essentially, when you take an amplitude of a cosine term large, and there's a minus sign here, the field inside the argument of the cosine, you want them to be, what, 0, right? And so a reasonable approximation is to say, well, they live near 0 with small fluctuations, so you change the sign here, you put a 1/2, and you make it Gaussian theory, right? And that's what we're going to do for each of these terms when we take them large. And so, for example, in the single vortex hopping term, when you do that, you can choose a gauge. You can think of this actually as the condensation of a single vortex, and you can basically get away with choosing a gauge in which theta is equal to 0. And so this thing sets A equal alpha, or it sets curl of A equals curl of alpha. Oh, and I didn't shoot. The one other thing I have to specify when I write down this gauge theory like this is the gauge constraints when I write as a Hamiltonian on the space of the gauge invariant states, which define the theory. And I'm sorry, I didn't do that. And that's, so I want curl of alpha is the spin-on density, and curl of beta is the vortex density. Okay, so these are the fluxes that are attached. I'm sorry. But these are the gauge constraints in sort of a usual way in a gauge theory. Sorry about that. So, but then what I see is that I already said that curl of alpha was equal to the charge density. And curl of A is a charge density, and curl of alpha is the density of spin-ons. And so when I have the charge density equal to the density of spin-ons, what it means is each spin-on has had a charge E glued back to it, and has become an electron. And one's just going to recover a theory of electrons hopping around on a lattice. And one can really push this through in a fair amount of rigor if one so chooses. if one cranks up the paravortex hopping term, the I can tell you just in a nutshell, why you get a spin charge separated insulator is basically, if I look pictorially at a spinon and a vortex, inside the two-dimensional superconductor, we've already seen that and argued that the spinon picks up a minus sign when it goes around the vortex. So one has a square root branch cut, essentially coming off of the vortex if you are a spinon. And so if you have pairs of vortices proliferating and moving around and tightly, bound into pairs, and another, minus, then the branch cuts, originate on them can cancel on what the other one. And so you go into this phase, if you proliferate and condense pairs of vortices, you go into a phase where, on the one hand, you destroy the superconductivity, just like in sort of Costa-Salas, where you move around vortices, you destroy the phase coherence of the superconducting state. But you also end up in a phase where the spinons can now propagate as deconfined excitations, and they just carry the spin half and no charge. And so the states, the excitations you get in this spin charge separated insulator are the spinon, which is deconfined. You get a, you also, it turns out, you get a charge particle, a charge E boson, which is the topological excitation in the pair vortex condensate. But let me not even belabor that. And finally, you get a vison, which is essentially an unpaired vortex. If you consider pairing vortices and condensing, the pair, you can branch and breaking the pair apart and having a vison, but that's going to be a gapped excitation. Okay. And so it's really this vison which is absolutely central new excitation in the spin charge separated insulating state. And it, Sental, the former postdoc here, who most of you probably know, is now at MIT, 2 or 3 years ago, thought of a absolutely beautiful experiment to try to detect the vison. And the idea was, basically the pseudo-gap regime, and this is not really our idea, it goes way back to Anderson's RVB, but the pseudo-gap regime is a spin charge separated insulating state, if you will. And what one wanted to do was try to detect the vison in this region of the phase diagram. And I think in fact, there's too much time, the time's running, Fred, I'd just like to get to the roton spin of liquid. I will just not describe the experiment, just to tell you that this experiment was proposed a couple years ago, and Catherine Moldau up at Stanford, made some very nice, got her hands on some very nice single crystals of yttrium barium copper oxygen, which were very underdoped with a TC of around 10 Kelvin, and were able to, with a sample with a hole drilled into it, cycle up and down at very low temperatures and to try to measure whether or not one had a vison in the system. And the conclusion was that the energy gap for the vison is low, whereas the naively you would expect if this theory were applying is that the energy gap for the vison would be set by T star. Okay, so I think, I believe that, spin charge separation as a possibility for underlying the underdoped pseudogap regime in the cuprates is not really viable. I'm not sure everyone would agree with me on that, but.
And then before you go, could you just explain that in 4 minutes as easily as you did?
Yeah. Can I explain
this? Same Hamiltonian with factors of two.
Yeah. So. The thing is that there's going to be, when a vortex hops around, it's going to, I guess it's the simplest thing is to look at the spinons hopping around. It's really this term. You're wondering why I don't get an, yeah, okay, so there's a technical thing here, it turns out that in order to describe this state, one wants to take the same Hamiltonian and work in a different a sector of the theory. It is a little easier. And the sector of the theory is, in fact, a Z2 gauge set of gauge constraints, where when you have the twos in here, that is, you're allowed to choose, basically. Yeah, we're allowed to take alpha equal to zero or pi. If I impose the constraint that minus 1 to the f dagger f is equal to minus 1 to the curl of alpha. which is a Z2 gauge constraint. And it's a different sector of the same Hamiltonian, and it's much, I mean, it's simpler to see, you know, to recover the spin charge separated insulator in, say, in that case, because then there'd be a factor of 2 here when this is 0 or pi. 2 pi is, you know, gone under the cosine. Okay, so in the remaining 3 minutes, let me tell you about the property of this roton spin on liquid and just summarize its properties. So here we add a, okay, we're going to do the same thing with a roton hopping term. And so what we do in practice, for this case, we work in the U1 sector of the theory. We have this roton hopping term, which involves 4 theta fields. We expand the cosine to quadratic order. We then basically have a Gaussian theory, except for the spin-ons. We can do RPA. It's very, very tractable. We can just basically work out the properties of this state. And so this is the roton spin on liquid ground state. Okay, and on the one hand, it's very much like a superconductor. So call it almost a superconductor. Well, how's it like a superconductor? Yeah, so I'm considering, vortex neutral dipoles, which are free to move around in the ground state, and it's sort of a quasi-condensed. The remarkable thing, and this is that you would have thought, if that were the case, that if you put back a small single vortex hopping term into the Hamiltonian, and just that single vortices would be allowed to move around very easily. It turns out that's not the case. It's not the case because of a conservation law that emerges, and which I'll mention in a second. And that really relies, in fact, being on a square lattice as opposed to a triangular lattice. And so that's,
why wouldn't the plus and minus just annihilate each other?
They can, but we give them a large kinetic energy term, so they pop out of the vacuum in order to take advantage of that. I mean, it's if they annihilated one another, you'd be going back to the superconducting state. You know, and so we want to
balance between two things.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's.
You say there's enough of them.
Well, okay, we want to explore the phase diagram, and so we want to, if we crank up the coefficient of their hopping strength and make it larger than the repulsive interaction between the vortices, then they will prefer to pop out of the vacuum and move, right, to gain the kinetic energy, right? So this is almost a superconductor. There's no broken translational symmetry. What are the other features? Oh, the plasmon exists. The Goldstone mode. In fact, this phase at zero temperature has off-diagonal long-range order in the same way that you have in a superconductor. And moreover, at zero temperature, the resistance is zero, which you might have guessed if it has off-diagonal long-range order. However, it's not quite a superconductor. Okay, in what way is it not a superconductor? Well, it has no Meissner effect. It's not a superconductor. It has a full Fermi surface of spin-ons. And perhaps most dramatically different from a superconductor, there's a gapless Bose surface of rotons. OK, so now I'm sort of listing the excitations. Yeah, well, it's the bosonic analog of a Fermi surface. Yeah, I don't want to raise this one. Let me just do it. It's a loci it's a line in the momentum space along which the energy of these bosonic excitations vanish. I mean, one's used to, you know, a massless boson, you know, its energy vanishes at one point, you know, photon linearly. Okay, so if you just take this roton Hamiltonian diagonalize it, what you find is that that you get the zero energy excitations along these two lines. Well, I mean, we call this a Fermi surface, right? So.
Yeah, but it's a surface of the line.
Well, but I mean, you know, this is pair of boundary conditions. What's that?
The Fermi surface is an inside and
does
outside.
It? I mean, well, it depends, you know, it depends which zone scheme you're in, I mean, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah, anyway,
whatever.
The volume of the
There's no Luttinger's theorem here.
It has fermions on it that doesn't on the other side, or at least.
Well, no, but I mean, for me, yes, but I mean, I would say that there are particle excitations on this side, which cost a energy which is linear in the distance from the Fermi surface, and there are hole excitations on this side, which are linear in energy. Likewise, in this bosonic theory, the energy of the bosonic excitations off away from this line is linear in the distance. I don't know. It's just, whatever, I don't really care about the name. I mean, that's, but it's a gapless loci of bosonic excitations. What? Locus? Okay, thank you. And you know, there's an emergent symmetry which is going on here. I mean,
where does that come?
That it just comes from diagonalizing a quadratic Hamiltonian. So.
So this depends a lot on the crystal.
Yeah, it depends on the lattice structure. I mean, so when I expand this roton hopping term, you know, it was something. It's going to involve 4 theta fields, which if I write it in the continuum, which I'm not quite allowed to do, but it looks like a dx dy derivative squared. And then there's, you know, from this vortex stuff, there's an omega squared over k squared. And so the dispersion ends up being, you know, something like omega of k squared. You know, it's sine squared kx over 2 sine squared ky over 2. This is the kx squared ky squared, you would guess. And then there's I think there's a sum of them at the bottom. Yeah, essentially this k squared down here. The really remarkable. Okay, so these are the properties at zero temperature of this phase. Let me just mention the finite temperature properties very quickly. Finite frequency. The point is the reason there's no Meissner effect is because it costs zero energy to put in a vortex. No, even to put in a vortex. But the problem is it's impossible to do is move the vortex around, right? There's the energy of getting it in, which is zero. And then there's the question of its dynamics. And the vortex, and so we can take the vortex, single vortex hopping strength T1, and do perturbation theory in that and ask, you know, can we move the vortices around? And you can do a renormalization group flow equation, you know. What you find is that, you know, depending on parameters, it has some scaling dimension. And it's basically what's going on here is, you know, you have a quasi one-dimensional dispersion here. And you, in fact, have a symmetry, which is the number of vortices on every row and column is conserved. And you can see that when you take this, you know. And so that's the symmetry of the fixed point. In the same way that the Fermi surface is a symmetry, which is a number of lambda quasi-particles in each patch of the Fermi surface is conserved. But then we can come in and hop a single vortex, which, you know, breaks that emergent symmetry, but can be an irrelevant perturbation. Because basically it's an orthogonality catastrophe, which one has in, you know, one-dimensional systems when one tries to tunnel a particle into one-dimensional systems. So it's crucial that one has this gapless excitations along lines for this. You know, if one does the exact same calculation on a triangular lattice, the dispersion would be slightly different, and the Bose surface wouldn't be a surface; it'd be a point with a k-squared dispersion, energy going as k-squared. And then if one came in and did perturbation theory in the single vortex hopping, one would find that it's always relevant. And so you wouldn't have this kind of intermediate phase where rotons are gapless and free to move around, but single vortices cannot move around. And so what's rather nice is you can look at the resistance at finite temperature. It's smaller than 2. This becomes relevant, and you get driven into the Fermi liquid, right? But we can now do perturbation theory in this, and what we find is that at finite temperature, the resistance goes as T to the gamma. Okay, and this is what gets, you'll see why this gets one excited, at least me. The gamma is 2 delta V minus 3. Okay, now delta, in order for the, maybe I've got this, let me just make sure I've got this right around. Yeah. In order for the single vortex hopping to be irrelevant, we need delta V bigger than 2. So equivalent, we need gamma bigger than 1. So right on the boundary where the roton spin on liquid becomes unstable to the Fermi liquid, the resistance is linear in temperature. Right, and this is a result which is true. Okay, this is even whether you have impurities present. The other thing one can work out is the angle resolved photo emission spectroscopy at finite frequency. I mean, basically, because it's off-diagonal long-range order, At zero temperature inside the roton spin on liquid, the electron creation operator is proportional to the spin on creation operator. Basically, the charge of the electron, which is a boson, has condensed. That's the Kuiper-Pairs have condensed as well. And so it turns out that inside this roton spin on liquid, the electron spectral function is sharp. That is, there really is a Fermi surface of electrons, if you will. I mean, with delta functions on this Fermi surface. Okay, which obey Luttinger's theorem for the electrons. And one can then calculate the scattering rate, the decay rate, as a function of energy of those electrons. And the electrons, can decay off anything. They can decay off other electrons, they can decay off phonons. What's important here is decaying off the rotons, right, the electrons. And what one finds is that parts of the Fermi surface, which are parallel to the x or y axis, because of phase space, you can sort of imagine, you get much more scattering. If you take an electron here, and you scatter it this way, and you scatter a roton. So then you get hotspots with, if we get it down, it's omega to the 2 plus gamma over 2. So this would be omega to 3 halves at its smallest. It has hotspots. So it's got some rather appealing phenomenological features. The Hall effect I could talk about on time, but it also has the Hall effect has a temperature dependence different than the cotangent of the Hall angle, we could talk about it. It's got a temperature dependence different than the temperature dependence of the electrical resistance. And so finally, the thing I wanted to mention, though, is, this is I've sort of told you about the properties of this phase, this new fixed point. What about its instabilities?
So how essential, it seems pretty essential, this conservation law that you mentioned. Yeah. The number of voices in
the it's absolutely critical.
But then, in answer to my previous question, you want the plus or minus not to be bound so much that they were annihilated, but you want them to be distributed.
Yeah, no, you do. So, I mean,
kind of they're squeezed from both sides, right?
Well, no, I mean, if they're annihilated, you're inside the superconducting state because you have no vortices, right?
But so you don't want them to move separately.
And okay, so what? Yeah, exactly. And so you could say, what's the microscopic motivation? None at this stage. There's a lot of macroscopic motivation, a phenomenological motivation. It's just the phenomenology looks kind of appealing. I mean, but we want to get to the microscopics. But let me just mention the instabilities. Just very quickly, just list them. I mean, there are basically three instabilities, the three sort of dominant instabilities of the RSO, fixed point. One is instability towards the Fermi liquid. And that's when this delta V is less than 2. And then, T1 gets driven off to infinity, if you will. And you get confinement. I mean, the charge gets glued back onto the spin-ons, and you should recover a Fermi liquid. The other instability is the instability which is signaled by, we expanded a cosine term in the roton hopping. Is that legitimate? Well, okay, to see whether expanding a cosine term is legitimate, you actually want to go to a dual representation and look at some vortex in that. So you can do that, and there's, in some dual variables from this, there's a instability towards the superconducting state. And there's a scaling dimension of some charge hopping process in this dual representation, which, when relevant, tells us that we weren't allowed to expand the cosine term. And that's basically equal, approximately equal to 1 over the scaling dimension of the vortex hopping process. And the third instability is towards spin-on pairing. We have a Fermi surface of spin-ons. Just as in a metal, we have a Fermi surface of electrons. We know, thanks to Walter, that almost always you'll get pairing. So that's probably the same here as well. Though it's not a rotationally invariant system, but what's particularly appealing? And now I'll just finish with the phase diagram again. So you flow to a spin-on paired roton spin-on liquid phase. So just let me call it a roton liquid. It's got all the same properties except that the Fermi surface is gapped out away from, if it's D-wave, away from nodal points. So it's very similar. Well, because the gap is the rotons are untouched basically, and the spin-ons pair And so the what was a gapless Fermi surface of spinons becomes, it gets gapped out in the same way that, if, you know, for example, electrons gets gapped out when they pair and go superconducting. So this is, you know, going into a phase with this, right? An anomalous average of F. Yeah, it conducts. Yeah, it conducts very well. I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, it's, you see, and it's, I mean, it was always almost a superconductor. It had zero resistance, zero temperature. It has off-diagonal range order, zero temperature. But in some sense, here it makes it look a bit like a metal because it's got a Fermi surface of electrons. And now it becomes more like a superconductor. Okay. So, so let me just draw the phase diagram. And I mean, the other sort of appealing thing phenomenologically is that the, if you look at, well, okay.
The spinon density is very low, right? It's like X.
No, the spinon density is like electron density. I mean, we're working around.
So yeah. Do I think of your RSL as like very few, a lot of spinons around a very few rotons? What's the relative density?
Well, no, I mean the roton density doesn't really make much sense. I mean, I don't think you can talk about it. I mean, it's not conserved. Yeah. But the spin-on number is, and that's electron density. Okay, so let me even put this line back in that. The storytelling, what one would do in the last minute here, would be to say we would like to imagine, for some unknown reason, microscopic reason, that the Hamiltonian that describes the copper oxygen sheets and the cuprates is living near the roton spin on liquid fixed point. And by near, what I would like to think is that one wants scaled down from, you know, 10 electron volts down to an electron volt, that the effective Hamiltonian describing the physics on this sort of electron volts and below scale is Hamiltonian, which is living near the roton spin on liquid fixed point. Okay. And then as one cools, one can get various instabilities. And, you know, these are really the three dominant instabilities. And in fact, they really aren't, well, I mean, under extreme conditions, you can get other ones as well. But and the three instabilities are towards a Fermi liquid, towards a superconductor, and towards spin-on pairing, right? Which is kind of a pseudo-gap line. So, so one would like to say that this strange metal regime, you know, is the roton spin-on liquid. You know, it's got the Fermi surface of spin-ons. Now, of course, it's really a zero-temperature quantum ground state. And it never, you know, even if this were right, I mean, you know, it never lives down to zero temperature, so it's always unstable. Well, yeah, okay, so, but on this side, yeah, as the superconductivity disappears on this side, the vortex core energy. The renormalized vortex core energy goes to zero as the vortices start to proliferate. And so if the renormalized vortex, if I say that the bare vortex core energy gets small, then the vortices become, it's much easier for them to, single vortices to move around. And, you know, I think, in other words, the point is, okay, I mean, also this phenomenology, the roton liquid phase is a very good conductor. But, you know, eventually you know you're going to be insulating over here. And so you're going to have to start moving single vortices around again, right? And so, actually what one would want to do here is to, you know, at the phenomenological level, what one needs to do is to posit an X dependence of the scaling dimension.
I mean, your problem is you can't get from RL or RSL to a F.
No, okay. Well, I'd want to say that this is RSL, this is RL, this is Fermi liquid, the superconductor. And then you can go from RL to an insulator by just condensing single vortices, and that goes to a confined, rather boring insulator. Now you might have said, why don't you go to a Fermi liquid? Well, the thing is, when you start moving around single vortices, if your spinons are already paired, then the single vortices, which pick up a minus sign around an individual spinon, don't care about pairs of spinons. And so then when you can, so over here, if the spinons, but once the spinons pair, then when you condense the vortices, if that's what happened, you actually go into an insulating state where the curl of A, where the charge itself gets clumped up. And it's over on this side when the spinons unpaired, you know, and then there's these branch cuts coming off the spinons seen by the vortices that you get the charge sucked up onto the spinons when the vortices become mobile. And so, I mean, that's what, you know, when, so one would like to then, you know, suggests, at least in phonology, this is what one wants, is that the conventional, that at zero temperature, they're all conventional phases. I mean, that is, this is a conventional insulator, maybe with, you know, stripes and, you know, breaking translational symmetry of some kind. This is a conventional Fermi liquid. This is a conventional superconductor. But this would have been an unconventional ground state if one could have got to it. This would have as well. And that's, that's basically it. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's going to how unstable it is with the Zeno-Marcinkian phase depends on. I mean, well, it's not going to be easy. The problem is because we had these two scalar dimensions, delta v, which is essentially 1/(delta c). This is vortex. This is charge, right? And you, in order to make the vortices, single vortices not hop around, you want to crank up delta v. But then it becomes very easy for the charge to hop around, and then it derives superconductivity. So it's I mean, I think what one needs to do is to work out the phenomenology in much, much more detail, and you know, try to make, you know, semi-quantitative predictions about various things. I mean, the thing I haven't mentioned is as you go into the superconducting phase, what I call Bose surface of Roton gets gapped out, and it gets gapped out in a particular way with a gap proportional to TC, and so forth. And so there are sort of, you know, quasi-universal things, which are akin to BCS theory, which describe the crossover from the Roton spinner liquid to the superconducting fixed point, right? And so, I mean, there's a lot of marginal, essentially marginal variables here, so that this is not absolutely universal trajectory, but you really expect certain essentially dimensionless numbers which would be an order of one, like the Roton gap to TC, and things like that. And so there are, you know, sort of somewhat semi-quantitative things one can start saying about the electron spectral function at finite energy inside the superconducting state and outside and so forth. And, you know, there's quite a bit of data just in the last year or two. Well, recently in STM measurements, but as well as in, you know, earlier in photoemission and stuff. I mean, what one really would like, though, is a, you know, smoking gun experiment like in the, you know, the Vison detection experiment, where you can, you know, shoot yourself in the foot by making a prediction that can be strongly falsified. And, you know, but I would like to be able to make a prediction which could be tested in a concrete way, you know, and in a definitive way like that. You know, I think it's intrinsically maybe a little bit harder. You know, for one thing, this Roton spinner liquid has got a lot of gapless stuff. It's, you know, it's not, you know, a nice gapped phase, topological order or something like that. And it's, moreover, it doesn't, if this is really right, in the ground state, you never are actually in that phase, right? So it's, you know, it's a little dicey, right? So I think it's intrinsically going to be not that easy to rule this out or convince anyone else that it's something.
No,
I mean, you know, I think, yeah, if nothing else, this exercise shows one that interacting electron systems can be much, much more complicated than, you know, free Fermi gas, you know, and that's, you know, who knows what phases are out there in three dimensions and fields and. Yeah, I just, you know, this is just one, you know, boneheaded.
You know, a couple of years ago when you were talking about bisons, you were advocating a philosophy very forcefully that saying that you should just look at different phases, classify them by symmetry properties, and one shouldn't even talk about them. So this is a shift.
No, I know, but I would say, no. It's not really. Yeah, no, but you want to say what the universal properties of the phase are, but you also have to know how to relate the microscopic electron fields to the particle-like excitations in that phase, right? So in other words, we have to know how to calculate the electron spectral function, you know, using these variables, which we know how to do because we know basically how we got to, you know, roughly how we got to the duality transformation. You have to, but I don't think I don't think the philosophy has changed. I think one wants to, I mean, what I was saying is one should, try to first, rather than solving the Hubbard model, well, if one could solve it, that's great. But if one can't, try to find effective theories which give one, you know, universal properties of interesting phases, which, you know, phenomenologically suggestive. And this is okay. This isn't just an effective theory, which allows us to do that.
Can I ask a question just for clarification? I'm saying this correctly. You're saying now the rotons, the kinetic energy of rotons, is what changes your dynamics of everything.
Yeah.
This is what you're emphasizing.
Yeah.
And these are still. These are phase fluctuations that are important here because that's what the vortices are all about.
Yeah.
My understanding is that this is the first time I hear that in the so-called strange mantle phase about this star, we are now talking about phase fluctuations of the supergalactic
one.
Isn't this bizarre? I mean, can you?
No, I mean, I don't. These are just the variables I'm using to describe this phase, right? Yeah, that's all. I mean, this roton spin on liquid has a Fermi surface of electrons, right? That doesn't seem bizarre.
You get it by cranking up the kinetic energy for these rotons. You think that, you know, once these phase fluctuations are not the dominant low energy excitations, then.
Okay, so this is coming back to the point, is I don't want to view these operators as creating the renormalized excitations inside the superconducting state. I want to view this as just a basis change. These are, you know, rather than working with C daggers C, I work with these things, and these Fs and thetas and Ns. And I want to argue, and you know, maybe this is not legitimate, that description in terms of these, you know, pseudo bare fields. They're bare in the sense that they describe the physics on electron volt scale. They're not, you know, obviously bare. They don't describe, you know, the atomic. You know, the atom correctly, living the, you know, the electrons, you know, on the 10, you know, 50, 100 electron volt scale. So, let me just say one thing. I mean, you know, if you look at the actual resistance in the strange metal, the material conducts extremely well, right? I mean, you know, tens of micro ohm centimeters. I mean, it's actually pretty damn good conductor. If you extrapolate it, which you know maybe not allowed to do, but below TC, it conducts even better. And you know, maybe it's got, you know, a lot of not necessarily. It doesn't have electron pairing necessarily. I mean, that's the roton spin of liquid has gapless electron excitations around the whole Fermi surface, but it has the seeds of superconductivity in the charge sector, right? I mean, in a way, we're getting superconductivity here without pairing electrons, right? I mean, in the sense at zero temperature, we have off-dying long-range order, but we have a Fermi surface of electrons, right? So it's like getting a superconductor without pairing. Except they don't. But on the other hand, the electron spectral function, because you have off-dying long-range order, is sharp. You know, so it's sort of almost due. Yeah, no, yeah, so it's, so, but, no, the superfluid density is zero. I mean, rho s is equal to zero. That's a red herring, Arun, I promise you. You can take, you know, you can take an infinite stack of layers with no Josephson coupling between them, and then it has no Miser effect still, right, of these phases. An infinite stack of roton spin on liquids decoupled with no tunneling of charge. Then there'd be no Meissner effect. Is what? Coupling of electrons, you mean? Well, no, because the electron spectral function is sharp at zero temperature, you can, although you will get quite a bit of strong scattering, I think you can get coherent. Yeah, out of the plane. In this theory, I think you can, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not criticizing the Hubbard model. It's just a challenging model, and I admire people that are trying to solve it, and eventually, you know, success will come. Yes, I'm putting in the D wave by hand, but that physics of D wave that comes in presumably is the physics that's coming out of the Hubbard model. I mean, you know, that I don't, you know, the physics is not changing really. What's changing here is the degrees of freedom I'm used to describe a different phase. I mean, that's, you know, but.
What happened to this U1 versus U2 issue? A couple of years ago, you were insisting that one should not use U1 fields because they confine in two dimensions, and in Z2 you would have the confining.
Yeah, no, but I'm not really. Okay, so these U1. I've got a Hamiltonian here, which in one sector of the theory is identical to the Z2 gauge theory in its dual representation. It's got enough symmetry that I can take a U1 sector as well. This is not the standard U1 gauge theories that, you know, that you were involved in developing. Well, no, but it's not the. These are non-compact actually. I mean, these alpha, the gauge fields are important here. are just to implement the statistical interaction. And you can take them as Z2 gauge fields if you want. And in fact, but it turns out to analyze the roton spin on liquid, it's much easier working with U1 gauge fields because it softens things up. I mean, it's really the difference. All that's going on here is if you attach pi, if you want to get a minus sign when you take a spin on around a vortex, you can either say, well, there's a branch cut coming off the vortex and the spin on wave function changes sign when you cross it. That's Z2. Or you can say you attached flux of pi and, you know, you pick up the gauge field, you know, gradually, but you get the phase of pi when you go all the way around. That's the U1 aspect here. You know, and that's, you know, that's like doing a, you know, an Halperin-Lee read in the quantum Hall effect where you're attaching flux. You know, you can, there, you know, you, okay. I mean, there, I think you maybe have to do it with a U1, actually. But, there.
It seems to me that the measure of resistivity in the underdog regime above T-star is actually very, very large. It's really not a good measure in that regime.
Well, no, it really depends on how far you go this way, right? Well, no, but actually, but no, well,
it increases very rapidly.
Well, no, if you come down here, it actually, the resistance drops below linear, and it drops.
Right. That's understandable in that picture because you're losing some scattering by gapping out.
Well, actually, in which picture?
Your picture.
Well, actually, in my picture, the spin-ons are trying to pair, and I haven't talked about this, but the electrical conductivity is actually a sum of the spin-on conductivity and the, you know, essentially, the roton conductivity. Well, you gain spin on conductivity.
You gain spin on conductivity.
Yeah,
and so you decrease resistivity.
Yeah, so that sort of works. But
above T star.
Up here?
Yeah, you need to have a resistivity which is very, very big.
Well, I mean, but it's big when you go up high in temperatures, but
as compared to what?
Well, okay, I mean, big maybe you would say is KFL is order 1 or something like that. Is that, I mean, the sheet resistance. But actually, KFL down here is large, like a 50 or 100. I mean, so the intrinsic resistances are pretty low. I mean, that material conducts well.
Around
optimal doping. I mean, when one goes towards underdoping, we need to let the vortices, you know, we're doing phenomenology. You know, but we have to recover insulating behavior. Once we've gone below the spin-on pairing line, we have to allow single vortices to move around. You know, as we come down into here, otherwise we're not going to get an insulating state.
You need a very strong dependence on the doping of your prefactoring RFP.
Yeah, well, it's doping depends on these scaling dimensions, which is what's important. And, you know, one really is going to need a non-monotonic, you know, scaling dimension of, which characterizes the, you know, the dimensions number characterizing the roton spin on liquid fixed point. You're going
to
need something which looks like this.
Yeah,
well, okay. No, I mean, I think, okay, so on the microscopic side, there are some hints, but they really aren't any hints, and I'm not that optimistic. But if you take the Gutzwiller projected BCS superconductor at finite doping, which is supposed to be a superconducting, you know, strongly correlated superconducting ground state, that ground state supports algebraically correlated circulating currents in the ground state, it appears. I mean, one has to, you know, that's at least what the current numerical status seems to suggest. Patrick Lee talks about these, right, as, you know, incipient d-density wave order. He wouldn't want to use those terms, but, so I think it's conceivable that, in fact, you just take a BCS superconducting wave function near half filling, but doped, and you Gutzwiller project, that you actually may be going into a roton liquid phase. I mean, it's not, maybe not, I mean, quite likely not, but it's not out of the question. It certainly seems to be something unusual about that superconducting state. I mean, the problem is that the numerics that people have done predominantly focus on things like off-dying long-range order, which it has. And, you know, it has a Fermi, it has a nodal, you know, quasi-particles. But these are all the things which are shared, that the roton liquid shares with the superconducting ground state. So the main difference is these gapless rotons, which are these, you know, which in fact give algebraic correlations in these circulating currents. And that comes out of the theory, in fact. That would be the most optimistic. Yeah, okay, so that shows up in the, like, structure function of the vortex-vortex correlator, I mean, which one, is something one can numerically extract from Gutzwiller-projected BCS wave functions, and, you know, the, you know, some of that has already been done, but I think one wants to do larger systems and more systematic and stuff to try to nail that down. You know, but that's, so I, you know, it's clearly one wants to, yeah, try to get a handle on, you know, what, if any, types of microscopic, you know, physical models could get one near this fixed point. And, you know, that's obviously much, well, that's more challenging, you know, for sure, than doing, you know, the universal sort of effective theory of some fixed point. So, I mean, there's a lot of work to do, you know, before, you know, declaring victory or quitting. That's the problem in the latter one. It's a lot of work. Could waste a lot of time, you know, before, but, yeah, well, thanks for sitting so patient. It's pretty fun. Yeah, I'm pretty psyched.